and where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together. Ha-ha! Barack Obama!
Yes, we can.
Barack Obama!
Everybody, and welcome to Galactic Roundtable with Beth Trutwin. We will spend the next little while working together on our ascension. We will work on personal, planetary, galactic, universal, omniversal, and cosmic ascension. The cosmos beyond describes all the non-physical antimatter universes. As we creator gods came to this part of the Nebadon universe, aeons ago, we birthed through Mother Sekhmet's Yani at Galactic Center. The end of time has been prophesied in many ethnic cultures for thousands of years. Last summer, August 17th, 2010, the Milky Way galaxy aligned with the sun. This marked the constellation movements of the Mayan calendar. It came sooner than the predicted December 21st, 2012. Time has speeded up due to the collective consciousness of totality and divine grace of all that is, raising their vibrations in a constant process of ascension to a level where we have surpassed the conjunct of the Milky Way with the sun. We are in the end times. It marks the end of the grand experiment of good and evil, of duality. It marks the end of the fallen angels on Earth planet. With their removal, we will become the 33rd member of the Intergalactic Confederation of Worlds. We all have incarnated in physical bodies on Earth to change from a planet of duality to a planet of peace. We are working with the Syrian commander, Barack Obama, who is the 9th member of the Syrian Council of Nine on Sirius A. His head of secret service is a physical template of Lord Tsananda, who we call King of Swords. Millions of walk-in souls living in human bodies are all telepathically connected and working together in every walk of life. Police, Interpol, government agencies, military, lawyers, judges, journalists, and too many to list here. Each of us play an important role, where the outcome will be the capture and arrest of the intergalactic war criminals, the fallen angels, who were trying to have Earth and her resources as their own, as well as tens of other planets. We, on the ground crew, work closely with the Galactic Federation, headed by the Admiral, Lord Tsananda, a higher aspect of the Prophet Jesus, also known as Yeshua, and the Captain, Lord Ashtar. They have full say in many of the aspects of this mission for Earth ascension. They work directly with President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, as well as millions of other white knights around the world. They ask that we call on them as we need to for more help in our lives to help us with our mission. Feel free to call on them and they will be there at your service. You play an important part in this as you wake up to truth and share the news with others. We must work together to dissolve the programming within the Matrix. I will be pre-recording this program every week. I will be doing it recorded, not live, because it is better for my life situation. It is also less expensive to do a program without the use of an engineer answering the calls and monitoring. I want to thank BBS Radio, the greatest internet radio in the galaxy, for inviting me to be here each week. This is our family and where we join to check in with each other at galacticroundtable.com. I keep this site up to date every day as part of my spiritual service. I have 2 volunteers working with me and they lovingly devote their service every day. I'm grateful for all who are part of the family at Galactic Roundtable. I manage to keep everything going with your donations and you may find a donation button on the site. I use the money for electric, Wi-Fi, server fees, and radio broadcasting. I thank you, everybody, for your continuous generosity and love. In exchange, I work hard to give back as much as possible, and you may look at my other website, www.cosmicascension.com. I am continuously adding to it, and there are many features for self-discovery and healing. This is a place where we go and we raise the questions, where am I? Who am I? Where am I from? And why am I here? I am beginning my charitable mission for World Service post-Nasara. You can find information about Antares Arcturus Midway Foundation at aamidway.com. And as we carry out lives of service to our fellow woman, child, and men on Earth inside the Matrix, we continue to have tests and challenges from that concept that I affectionately call 3D. The first dimension is a point in space. The second dimension is a plane, a flat, barren surface. The third dimension is latitude. Imagine a cube with six planes connected together, the top, bottom, and four sides, floating up and down. Within this cube is the third dimensional space. The fourth dimension is time, pure and simple, a point in space in relation to time on a timeline and a dimension. The fifth dimension is the etheric realm with no time. We exist there simultaneously now. We travel in our etheric bodies to the etheric realms at night when we sleep. Our etheric bodies are known by many names, such as our avatar body, like Jake Sully and Neytiri, the lion woman, in the movie Avatar. They are also known as our cosmic consciousness. We are multidimensional beings living on multidimensional Earth as one people, one land, one love. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable on BBSRadio.com Station 2, where we will discuss all things galactic with divine grace in the totality of all that is. Welcome. Greetings, everybody. It's Beth from Galactic Roundtable. I would like to jump right into a meditation tonight. It's been a really stressful week, so let's close our eyes and relax and come together in our hearts for a wonderful time together tonight. Relax your body in the preferred manner, observing your breath as it begins to slow down and your mind begins to relax. Now, imagine yourself laying in a large, comfortable hammock hanging between two large, shady willow trees. It is a warm day and you feel comfortable, even a little drowsy. The air is still and a butterfly is tumbling around you. Somewhere near you, hear the soft drone of a bee. It is a relaxing, almost sleepy kind of sound. Gently you sway to and fro in your hammock, making the most of this moment. Sleepily you glance upward to a deep blue sky with fluffy patches of white, big billowing clouds that are moving very slowly overhead. You try to follow them with your eyes and observe them as they slowly change shape. There is one cloud that seems to be hanging right overhead. It is a nice cloud, a friendly sort of cloud. And as you continue to lazily watch it with half-open eyes, you get the impression that the cloud seems to be coming closer and closer still. Yes, the cloud is slowly descending towards you. You want to keep watching it, but your eyes are so heavy. You feel sleepy. Your eyes are beginning to close, and you just give in and relax into this drowsy sensation, feeling safe and comfortable. Gradually, you perceive a cool, refreshing sensation over the entire body. You know you have been enveloped by this cloud, and it is a delightful and most comforting feeling. Cool, fresh, light, light as a feather, and there is no fear. You know you are safe in this relaxed and dreamlike state. Then, barely noticeably, you feel the cloud lifting you ever so gently, lifting you out of your hammock and slowly up, up into the blue. You are now floating in the clear blue sky, lying on the soft, cool cloud. And for a moment, you just enjoy this feeling of weightlessness in the clarity of the blue sky. Gently, you roll over and peek down over the edge of your cloud. There is a countryside below. You see little patches of woods, fields with the small silver streams meandering through them, glittering like quicksilver in the reflection rays of the sun. Small farms are dotted here and there. You notice some grazing cows, even tiny tractors that look like toys. What a tranquil view this is. You are at peace with yourself, enjoying the view. Life is not complicated from this perspective. Everything has its place and its reason to be. There is no worry, no strife, just life and ever-changing forms of energy, a constant becoming. Weightlessly, you continue to drift on your cloud, treasuring the moment. You have been traveling for some time now in this dreamlike state, and you notice your cloud descending softly, very gently. Soon you can see the willow trees with your hammock. You become aware of gradually, slowly drifting down to your special place. Light as a feather, to be gently placed back into your hammock, you wiggle yourself into a comfortable position and let out a little sigh. Above you, the cloud is gradually drifting off into the distance. Relaxed and refreshed, you ponder your experience. You look about your familiar place and you wonder, was it just a dream? Slowly become aware of your surroundings again. Become aware of your body and your surroundings. Take a deep breath, feeling new energy entering your system. Gently move hands and feet. Take another deep breath. Raise your shoulders and stretch your legs. Finally, when you are ready, open your eyes. Take notice of how you feel. Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining with me again this week on Galactic Roundtable. Tonight, I would like to talk with you about Ashtar and UFOs. I would like to read to you from my new book, Lord Ashtar and the Galactic Federation. It will be out to buy on Amazon in the next week, and it's available now for ebook to download. You can find that on www.galacticroundtable.com. I would also like to read to you from one of the books that Ashtar wrote, the Agni Purana, and share with you some of his wisdom. We're going to do that a little bit later in the program. For now, I would like to take you to a special presentation called Where Are the UFOs? And thank you as I get used to this new presentation mode of video.
Unidentified, alien, extraterrestrial, UFO. There are some who say that we are at a crossroads, a place and time where startling answers to momentous questions about life from other planets will soon be disclosed. They can offer proof that we are regularly visited by otherworldly beings who travel in advanced spacecraft, proof that our lives are being studied, sampled, and manipulated, proof that we are not alone. There are witnesses, photographs, and motion pictures that suggest an alien presence can be detected on our horizons and on our land in strange patterns that appear mysteriously in fields of wheat. Some contend that the proof lies in the desert, where an alien spacecraft slammed into a remote ranch near Roswell, New Mexico. There are others who tell of a secret flying saucer test site in the desert at a technological dreamland known only as Area 51. But some refuse to simply believe. In the face of remarkable stories and sighting reports, scientists conduct a real search for extraterrestrial intelligence in a coordinated global effort of deep space exploration called SETI. And new information is emerging. It points to the brain, and it looks to the mysteries of the mind as the source for this modern enigma, the UFO. These recent studies may shed new light on what humanity calls UFOs and close encounters. They may also reveal a myth, a modern myth that begs a question. Where are all the UFOs? Years, UFO images and stories have shaped our beliefs and enticed our imaginations in astonishing ways. But where does the UFO come from? Few of us have ever seen a UFO or noticed anything in the sky that didn't seem to belong there. Even fewer claim that they have been hauled inside a flying saucer. Still, 5 out of 10 people believe that alien spacecraft are in our skies, piloted by intelligent travelers from other planets. Where do these widespread ideas originate? Some say the seeds were planted by the time 32 million people gathered around radios on the night of October 30th, 1938.
We interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead.
Millions believed that the H.G. Wells radio drama, The War of the Worlds, was a real report of a Martian invasion. The result was a widespread panic. The director, Orson Welles, was unaware that his production had struck a nerve.
I'm of course surprised that the H.G. Wells classic, which is the original for many fantasies about invasions by mythical monsters from the planet Mars, had such an immediate and profound effect upon radio listeners.
The effect was indeed profound. The German psychologist Carl Jung would later write that the fear of an invasion from outsiders was real and came at a time of growing paranoia from an escalating world war in 1938. Wells had provided a name and shape to the unknown intruders that lurked in our imagination. That name was Martians. Before science offered explanation, the passing of a comet was met with fear and panic. Other unexplainable phenomena were labeled angels, fairies, and leprechauns in simpler times when man's fears of invasion were bounded by the power of horses, wind, and steam. But the 1940s ushered in the rocket age. Radar allowed us to see in the dark, and soon we would harness the power of the atom. We were getting used to wonders, so why not visitors from outer space? The UFO legend began with no photographs, no radar reports, and no physical evidence. Only one man's story. It was the kind of story that would come to be known as a sighting. Kenneth Arnold was a 32-year-old successful businessman on the summer day that his sighting took place. He sold firefighting equipment and flew his own light plane. On Tuesday, June 24, 1947, Arnold was flying toward Mount Rainier above the Cascade Mountains of Washington State. The air was smooth and clear as he reached 9,200 feet and noticed a bright flash. To the left and north of Mount Rainier, he saw what he described as 9 peculiar objects flying at over 1,200 miles per hour. As they passed the mountain, the objects were outlined against the snow. They traveled in a V formation and were skipping through the sky in such a way that Arnold said they resembled a saucer skipping across water. Arnold first told his story upon landing at the Yakima, Washington airport. He sketched a series of diagrams to illustrate what he had seen. What he drew was shaped like a crescent 50 feet long and only 3 feet thick. It had a rounded point in the rear. When seen edge-on, he reported, they looked like a black line. Journalists were naturally skeptical of Arnold's story, but because of his stature as a pilot, businessman, and deputy sheriff, the skepticism changed to wonder, and the newsman reported the incident as serious news. It was not long before the story of Arnold's sighting startled the world. The newspapers quickly coined a name for Arnold's skipping discs. The name was Flying Saucers. Kenneth Arnold was soon to enjoy a celebrity status. As the author of a book and the subject of magazine cover stories, he was looked upon as a combination of Einstein, Flash Gordon, and Screwball. Still, the press would anoint him the man who started it all. By the summer of 1947, the age of the flying saucer had arrived. In the days and weeks after Arnold's sighting, there followed a rash of reports which would firmly lodge the idea of flying saucers in the public imagination. One of those reports came only 14 days after Arnold spotted his 9 skipping discs. It originated in the New Mexico desert outside a remote community called Roswell.
The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
It had been 2 weeks since Kenneth Arnold reported his famous flying discs above the cool mountains of Washington State in 1947. More people knew about flying saucers at this time than about the Marshall Plan for the post-war reconstruction of Europe. Now, the attention would turn to the desert. Roswell, New Mexico, lies deep in the flat, thirsty lands of the Southwest. It is a rural place whose very name conjures up memories of an alleged UFO crash and government cover-up. It is central to the UFO myth and remembered as the Roswell Incident. In the summer of 1947, the Army airfield here in Roswell was home to the elite 509th Bomb Group. During World War II, B-29 bombers that carried the atom bomb originated here. And 48 years ago, so did an event that gave substance to the belief in flying saucers.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
The press release that I received stated that we had in our possession parts of a crashed flying disc. The material was found on a ranch north of Roswell.
Walter Pott was public information officer of the 509th Bomb Group. He was instructed to dispatch his press release to the radio station and newspapers in Roswell. The story quickly fed the imagination of a nation where hundreds of flying discs had been reported in recent months. But the story ended abruptly. When General Ramey, commander of the 8th Army Air Force, took charge and issued a new statement, it wasn't a flying disc after all.
To me, I think it was one of the slickest cover-ups by admitting that we had the material and then a higher authority says, no, you don't.
But was it just a weather balloon that crashed here in the summer of 1947? Here in the desert outside of Roswell is where a field of strange metallic debris is said to have been found by a rancher named Mac Brazel as he inspected his grazing land. It stretched nearly 3/4 of a mile in length. He had alerted the airbase, wondering who was going to clean it up. Jesse Marcel Jr. recalls that his father, the intelligence officer at the Roswell Army Airfield, had been dispatched to the debris site to determine what had crashed there.
The night that my dad came home, he was very excited. He woke my mother and myself up and said he wanted to show us something very strange. And as I recall, he said this was parts of a flying saucer. I was 11, almost 12 at the time, and I had seen pieces of an airplane, weather balloons, and things like that, but this was not like anything that I'd ever seen before. And the most intriguing portion of the debris that I recall seeing was what appeared to be I-beams. When I looked at this with the light reflecting on it, I noticed what appeared to be some symbols or writing along the inner surface of this I-beam, and the implication was this was something that came from some other planetary system.
While researching a book on the Roswell incident, author Kevin Randall would learn details about other debris Marcel had collected.
You have something called metal foil, been described by various people as like tin foil or lead foil. You wad it up into a ball, you drop it on the table, it unfolds itself and there's no sign of a crease.
Randall discovered evidence that a thorough cleanup of the debris site took place under security so tight, even the sheriff was not allowed entry.
What we understand is you have riflemen on the high points around there, facing outward. You've got men cleaning the debris field, putting the material in wheelbarrows, moving it to collection points so they can be put into trucks brought back. Eventually, they crawled across the area, shoulder to shoulder, picking up all the little bits and pieces they could find.
Although no trace of the Roswell flying saucer can be produced to support these claims, the story expanded. There were reports of a second crash site. Frankie Rowe's father said he had seen extraterrestrial beings here.
They'd gotten a call on what they thought was a plane crash about 30 miles north of Roswell. And when they got out there, it was not an airplane. He said it was a flying saucer that had crashed. And there were little, what he called little people, and he said one of them was still alive, that there were two that were covered up laying on the ground, and he said they had been covered up in like body bags, and the one that was walking around there didn't appear to be hurt.
Through his research, Kevin Randall has established what he believes happened next.
According to a number of the eyewitnesses, the craft and the bodies were taken to Hangar 84 at the Roswell Army Airfield, where they were held for a period of time before the various flights were initiated and sent out of Roswell.
Randall believes that crates containing alien bodies and all the metallic flying saucer wreckage were loaded out of the center of the heavily guarded Hangar 84, never to be seen again.
There obviously was a cover-up of this accident, because years later my dad said he was actually part of the cover-up because he went along with the weather balloon story.
Marcel confided that he was even ordered to pose for photographers with wreckage from such a weather balloon.
People in the town knew about it. Some of them had information. These people were visited by military authorities. They were told to keep quiet.
Frankie Rowe recalls such a visit from a man in a uniform.
He started getting louder, and he kept saying, "Don't you understand? You did not see anything." Then he had a nightstick type of thing with him that was kind of hanging on his belt. And he took that out and got very loud, and he started talking, and every time he would make a point, he would hit his hand with the nightstick, So he would say, you didn't see anything. You were not there. And he said, if you ever say one word about this the rest of your life, we will split up this family. If that's not enough, he said, you know, this is a big desert out here. We can take you out in the desert. And he said, no one will ever find your bodies.
These are troubling and sincere memories from a time 50 years ago. But these stories and others like them make up the body of evidence that we have regarding the Roswell incident. There are no shreds of foil to examine, only the photograph of a man posed with debris from a weather balloon. They are central to a myth that began in 1947 about flying saucers in the sky. Soon the Air Force would begin a series of secret investigations or projects aimed at discovering what mysteries might lie behind the UFO reports. The first was codenamed Project Sign.
Project Sign wrote a final report called The Estimate of the Situation, which concluded that UFOs were interplanetary vehicles. You can imagine that this didn't go over well at the Pentagon. If Roswell was really a crashed alien spacecraft, the government military could not have the idea of UFOs as an interplanetary spacecraft coming out when they'd been trying to cover up the Roswell crash.
By December of 1948, Project Sign was renamed Project Grudge. The Air Force hired astronomer J. Allen Hynek of Ohio State University to weed out reports that were caused by meteors, planets, stars, or comets. Some of the reports, like this lenticular cloud formation, were easily explained as atmospheric anomalies. This 1951 photograph of objects traveling in a V-shape over Texas became known as the Lubbock Lights. Analysis proved these to be birds reflecting light. This film was submitted from Great Falls, Montana in 1950. It depicts bright white dots moving behind the smokestacks of a grain mill. The photographer described the objects as shiny, bright, and metallic, like polished silver. Project Grudge concluded that these were F-94 Air Force interceptors landing in the area. In early 1952, after investigating and dismissing hundreds of flying saucer stories, Project Grudge was reorganized into Project Blue Book. The term flying saucer would be replaced by the term UFO, or Unidentified Flying Object. Major Hector Quintanilla Jr. was in charge of the new Project Blue Book staff.
The objectives of the program are twofold. They're the same as they have been since 1953 when the regulation was written. First of all, to try to determine if the UFO phenomenon presents a threat to the security of the United States. And second, to determine if the UFO phenomenon exhibits any technological advances which could be channeled into research and development.
This film, taken in Utah in 1952, was submitted to Project Blue Book for examination. After a frame-by-frame analysis, the white dots here were originally classified as intelligibly controlled vehicles. But further analysis revealed minute changes in the light intensity that eliminated the possibility that the images in the Utah film were aircraft. 1 year later, the project concluded that they were in fact seagulls known to inhabit the Great Salt Lake area. Although dozens of other cases remained unexplained, Project Blue Book, the Air Force's final project concerning the UFO phenomenon, concluded that UFOs posed no threat to national security and held no promise for technology. Blue Book was terminated in 1969, allowing the Air Force to ignore further UFO reports. While the Air Force held fast to its explanation of the Roswell incident as nothing more than a crashed weather balloon, newsreels reflected a public that continued to watch the skies hoping to glimpse a spacecraft. Suddenly, people from coast to coast began seeing something up there. What followed was a popular movement that embraced flying saucers and the spacemen who were thought to pilot them. Ready or not, The flying saucers were coming.
Within a matter of several days, I will myself make what might be called a flying saucer, although I don't choose to call it that because it may not respond to our controls.
To the vast majority of the people in the late 40s and 1950s, flying saucers were a terrific novelty. And there was a great deal of popular fascination. There were cheesy science fiction films based on the idea of the Martians were invading the Earth with flying saucers.
Popular magazines printed on pulp paper would hit the newsstands in time to cash in on the trend and expanded to legendary proportions. The man behind those flying saucer legends was publisher Raymond Palmer.
Palmer was a man who in his youth had been severely injured, and so he was crippled up, and he was what you would call a hunchback, I guess. He had the instincts of a carnival barker. He liked to put something over him. And the thing about Palmer was that his fans liked having Palmer put something over them.
It was Palmer's Fate magazine, later called Flying Saucers magazine, which helped to shape and define the UFO myth into a familiar system of supernatural beliefs. Attacks, invasions, and alien occupants played across these colorful pages. It was here, of course, that UFOs had become identified. Now, everyone knew they were flying saucers from other worlds. What followed was a craze in the 1950s known as the contactee movement. Contactees were people who believed that they had made contact with space people.
I was aboard a flying saucer in the Nevada desert on 11 different occasions. I was taken into this monstrous saucer by one of the men and confronted with a lady captain, beautiful complexion, beautiful appearing woman, and a peaceful people. They mean no harm to us. They come down here to investigate what's going on Earth. And they certainly convinced me that they're peaceful, and they come from another planet they call Clarion. They told me there was life on Mars and that there were life on other planets as well, and all planets except Earth had interplanetary means of travel.
The man credited with starting the contactee movement was a Polish immigrant and self-styled philosopher named George Adamski. In his book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, he detailed a claim that he had met a landed flying saucer in the desert of Southern California in 1952.
Oh, I was picked up on a desert, the California desert, and I was taken in the mothership, and they were flown around, not too close to the moon, but with instruments, similar, you might say, except it wasn't a camera, it was really sort of a telescopic instrument that we were able to see what was on the moon on the other side of it, see?
Adamski's book chronicled his meeting with a man from Venus named Orthon. It contained photographs of the scout ship he claimed came to pick him up. It included diagrams of the interior of the craft and detailed important features such as the chart room, but went on to include the kitchen and dormitory. His diagram of a Venusian mothership was accurate right down to the lounge. When he departed, Orthon would leave behind these enigmatic footprints, which Adamski explained contained an important message urging man to cease nuclear testing on Earth. His followers made similar reports.
I was taken on board a 200-foot diameter spacecraft in the Mojave Desert, and while I was on the craft, they presented me with this little crystal stone. They told me it was called Martian jasper.
The contactee myth offered an escape from what some saw as an inevitable nuclear war. These aliens had come down from utopian planets, and like angels, they wanted to prevent war and stop nuclear testing. Best of all, they looked like us.
I have a picture here of the gentleman who escorted me through the craft, and I would like to show it and describe it. This gentleman, he appeared almost as I am.
except that he was about 5 feet 10 inches tall, weighing about 150 to 155 pounds, and they all appeared about that same size, including the lady.
George Adamski would publish 2 more volumes on his contacts with beautiful space people from Saturn and Mars. He even had opportunity to take home movies of the scout ships that visited him, guided by robot pilots from Venus.
Everything is a push-button idea, and everything is operated by a robot system. Even the space people, as we call them, their minds are not so developed as to be able to cope with the speeds and the conditions of space as they venture through space. So the robot system is the one that detects most of the thing and controls the ship and governs the ships in general. See, they're only there, you might say, to look after their robot, see how the robot does operate.
The impact of Adamski's tales led to an explosion of flying saucer clubs and conventions.
As the flying saucer phenomena continued into the 50s, civilians began to become very interested, of course, people did, and clubs formed up with a classic meaning of the term club, hobbyists, as it were, that were just interested in the wilder, esoteric aspects of the phenomena, particularly the stories of people who said they were in contact with aliens.
Many of the contactees would meet up at the largest and most widely publicized flying saucer festival ever. It took place in California in March of 1954 and was called the Giant Rock Convention. It attracted over 5,000 outer space enthusiasts.
How many trips have you made out of space?
Oh, I'd say 350 or a few more.
When was the last one?
First part of June.
And who did you go with?
People from Jupiter.
I have made telepathic contact for the past 8 years with many space people from many areas of space, both inside and outside of the solar system.
Lectures were given from the Giant Rock, and stalls were set up to sell books, photos, and space-age souvenirs. Most importantly, conventions like this gave the contactees a place to exchange ideas, rumors, and reports.
But I do believe what I see, and I am one of those who was inside of flying saucers.
They told me that language was no barrier to them anywhere. They could speak any language.
So they told you that in English?
Yes.
I seem to become one with the entire universe. Everything in the universe seemed to be compacted down to one small dot.
What were their clothes like? The woman had a radiant red box-pleated skirt and a black velvet-appearing blouse and a black and red sam or beret, and the men had clothes very similar to our Greyhound bus drivers.
Like Adamski, the contactees gave astonishing details of the spacecraft they had been taken aboard.
On July the 12th, I took a trip in a flying saucer, which I'm pointing right here. The saucer was well equipped with rooms, bedrooms, bathrooms, toilets, and this saucer. I went up into Mars, over the moon, Venus, Clarion, and Orion. When I say Orion, I do not mean Orion. It is a planet outside of our galaxy.
Also present in the new UFO myth was a belief that startling evidence was about to be revealed.
We are going to see more and more of these visitors from space, and that before too long, the evidence will be incontrovertible that you will have on your TV screens and on your movie screens concrete evidence that the ships are here and that they are real and they're not fantastic things which have been cooked up to make a movie.
Could the UFO mystery ever be explained? The answer is there would be more questions. They are round. They are cigar-shaped, and they are cylindrical. Some appear to be sleek and smooth, as if made of stainless steel, while others appear bolted together from some alien cast iron. At night, they are described as having flashing lights. They appear without warning, hover erratically, and disappear. Most UFO photographs and films have been identified as natural phenomena or as hoaxes. Some UFOs appear in photos when we least expect them and defy any explanation or analysis. This is what fuels the UFO myth.
UFO photo cases are tantalizing because they're some type of what you might think of as objective proof. The UFO phenomenon is ephemeral, and normally all we have are reports of witnesses on a piece of paper and a tape recorder. But with photos, you think you have something physical.
But do UFO photos really offer proof of extraterrestrial intelligence in our skies? This series of photos remains among the most compelling examples of what ufologists call a daylight disk. The photographs were taken on July 29, 1952, by George Stock outside of his lawnmower shop in Passaic, New Jersey. Stock reported that as he was working outside at 4:30 p.m., he looked up to see something unusual flying overhead. Using an inexpensive box reflex camera, he snapped pictures of what he described as a disc-shaped object with a metallic bottom. It hovered momentarily, then accelerated and flew away. We may never know if Stock saw a real flying saucer, created a hoax, or was himself fooled by someone else's hoax.
Having looked at photos for 20 years, I would say that probably the bulk of what I have been given are honest mistakes by people.
Dr. Bruce McAbee is an optical physicist employed by the United States Navy. His official research involves high-energy space lasers, but his interest also lies in the detailed analysis of UFO photographs.
I recently received a photograph from a lady who says she took a photograph of a sunset at night, and to her great surprise, after it developed, very thin oval-type bright images appear. They're in a straight line. This looks very suspicious to me because this is exactly the thing that would happen if somebody were to take a photograph through a window and have lights in the ceiling which were in a line, and you would get some sort of a reflection.
Still, other UFO photographs represent a deliberate attempt at a hoax. The photographer of these saucers over England admitted to pasting disc-shaped paper cutouts on his window before shooting the picture. Of particular interest to Dr. McAbee are photos which defy explanation and show no evidence of a hoax or misidentification. One such case began at a farm in rural Oregon in 1950.
These are two photos taken by a farmer and his wife in 1950 in McMinnville, Oregon. Here's the first photo, and here's the second, and we'll get a little bit of a blow-up on these.
Using image enhancement equipment, McAbee brings into focus the startling photographs that were taken in the early evening with a simple camera.
See, that's an oval object with a little thing on the top, like a little protrusion at the top of it. This is obviously a hoax of the real thing. There's no halfway point. See the image clearly enough to see that it's not a bird, a plane, or Superman. So the next question is, what could it be? And if we go back over here, we can see that there are electrical wires right up above the object. And again, at the blow-up. Now the question is there any evidence of a suspension underneath the wires?
A contrast-enhanced version of the Oregon photo reveals minute scratches that McAbee must distinguish from a string or line that might have been attached to the object to suspend it for a hoax.
No one has found any evidence of a line going up above the object. There is a possibility that this thing might have been thrown and photographed, except that the image is not blurred by motion.
What the analysis provides, however, is proof only that something was photographed in the sky. There is no evidence here that points to extraterrestrial spacecraft unless that is what you believe. McAbee also demonstrates how blurring can be used to create the impression of a UFO where there was only an out-of-focus cook pot suspended by a wire. Other flying saucer images are also in focus but simply look too good to be true, such as the case of the astounding photographs taken by a farmer named Billy Meyer.
Billy Meyer is a Swiss man who has taken lots of photographs and lots of movie footage, all of which I think are faked. He's the only one that manages to photograph the ships. He's the only one that sees the stuff or channels the stuff.
Billy Meyer claims to be contacted telepathically by space travelers from the constellation of the Pleiades. He is instructed to set up his camera in time to photograph craft that Meyer calls the beam ships.
And these photographs are taken over a beautiful Swiss valley. They seem to show these objects coming in under conditions of broad daylight. But photo analysis shows, not surprisingly, that these are small objects, not very far from the camera, apparently from a fishing pole line.
His movies are even more startling, because if they are authentic, they would represent clear and distinct proof that flying saucers are real and validate the UFO belief system. Not surprisingly, they have come under the scrutiny of Dr. McAbee.
One particular section that I was interested in when I saw it, I said, looks to me like pendulum motion of this object. This is a scene showing a house in the background and a big tree, and the object's swinging back and forth, and then near the end it seemed to actually contact this big tree again. Everybody's saying, wow, it's on top of a big tall tree. How can this possibly be a hoax?
McAbee noted that although Meyer's camera remains stationary, his beam ship never leaves the view of his lens. This supports McAbee's conclusion that this film was taken of a relatively small light object suspended by a string and swinging like a pendulum around a small mottled tree.
The bottom line for me is that I can't say that Meyer has not had any experiences. He may well have. But I'm not using any of his video or photos or whatever as what I would consider scientific evidence that there really are aliens flying around out there.
Still, other photographic evidence, such as this image, taken by a geological survey team off the coast of Brazil in 1958, point away from hopes and toward the sighting of a real flying saucer.
A Brazilian naval photographer on a ship was there with the rest of the men when they saw an object shaped like Saturn, in other words, an object with a ring around it, flying toward an island that they were near, Trinidad Island, flying around the island and then taking off in the distance. And he snapped four or five or so or more photos of the object with literally dozens and dozens of witnesses.
The sighting lasted nearly 2 minutes. First, the object was reported to approach the island. Then, it disappeared behind a mountain. It then reappeared before moving off at high speed toward the sea.
Now, these pictures show something. It's not an ambiguous object that could be anything. This is clearly a structure that somebody built. It doesn't look like anything that we have on Earth. There were all these witnesses who saw the picture being taken. For these reasons, the photographs are unusually evidential and have to figure in any kind of case for the reality of UFOs as somebody's technology.
Because this is a multiple witness case done by scientists and a professional photographer and has many photographs, it probably has to be taken seriously as the number one photographic case in UFO history.
Many people consider that if UFOs represent extraterrestrial intelligence, then they would simply land on the United States White House lawn and prove to the world that they exist. In 1952, those people almost had their proof.
Perhaps the most important sighting of all time was the so-called Washington merry-go-round. that occurred in late July 1952, it seems to have been a whole set of anomalous objects that appeared over secure airspace in the Capitol, over all of the famous important buildings that paced craft around Washington National Airport, that was seen by a variety of radars at the time.
At 11:40 p.m. on Saturday, July 19, 1952, an air traffic controller at Washington National Airport spotted seven blips in a corner of the radar scope. They were moving at 100 miles per hour and were heading for the Capitol. No aircraft were known to be in the area. Jet interceptors were scrambled to investigate the UFOs, but within moments, the radar blips had disappeared. When the jets landed, the UFOs returned.
That sighting has never been adequately explained. Because it happened in Washington, D.C., it alerted everybody right on up to the President of the United States and caused a national press conference by the Chief of Intelligence of the Air Force to try to calm everybody down.
At his press conference, General Sanford, Air Force Intelligence Director, confirmed that the objects were not secret American weapons and reiterated the Air Force's obligation to investigate the UFO.
We have received and analyzed between 1 and 2,000 reports that have come to us from all kinds of sources. Of this great mass of reports, we have been able adequately to explain the great bulk of them, explain them to our own satisfaction. However, there have been a certain percentage of this volume of reports that have been made by credible observers of relatively incredible things. This group of observations that we now are attempting to resolve. We have, as of date, come to only one firm conclusion with respect to this remaining percentage, and that is that it does not contain any pattern of purpose or of consistency that we can relate to any conceivable threat to the United States.
In spite of this supposedly open address on the subject of UFOs, there remained those who believed that the Army knew more about flying saucers than it would reveal.
In the 50s, there was the belief that the U.S. Air Force had proof of some sort that these were alien spaceships and was covering it up to prevent panic, that, in fact, the government not only knows about flying saucers, but is in cahoots with the aliens, that there is a technology exchange going on.
There is little to support the claim that any government has alien flying saucers in its possession. In the years following Roswell, the Army Air Force designed and tested a number of saucer-like craft, but none appear to be of alien origin or especially flight-worthy. But some say that the government has been test-flying captured alien flying saucers for years in a remote territory that lies deep in the desert of Nevada. In the center of the Nellis Air Force Range, they point to the top-secret dry lake bed here they call Area 51. Visitors to this spot are monitored from the restricted airspace above and by ground vibration sensors that detect their unwelcome approach. The surrounding mountaintops hold still other devices that scan for any movement from below. Once they are alerted, private security forces move in to discourage the curious from getting closer. For those who defy these measures trying for a glimpse inside, there is one last chilling warning. Deadly force will be used if you come any closer. Are military secrets hidden here? Or is there more?
There's a new body of folklore growing up around UFOs, and this is associated with Area 51, which is part of the Nevada test site. And the story is that flying saucer technology is being tested and flown in extraordinarily advanced aircraft that are being developed there. There doesn't seem to be any question that there are extraordinarily advanced aircraft being test flown there. This has been going on for some years. Area 51 was the development site used for the MiA-117 stealth fighter. U.S.-operated MiGs have flown from that area. These are extraordinary vehicles, and if you had seen, say, an F-117 in flight before it had been publicized, you would not have known what to make of it. It would have been a UFO in a very real sense, an unidentified flying object.
The stealth fighter is truly an incredible aircraft, and few could even dream of it in the 1970s. To observers near Area 51 at that time, it would have appeared surprisingly alien and worthy itself of a flying saucer report.
What's really interesting is that as long ago as 1947, people were reporting the boomerang-shaped UFO, which now looks very much like what is being flown as part of the stealth technology. It is interesting that certain kinds of aircraft that undeniably exist look very much like the people reported as UFOs from many years.
Some believe that the source of such technology is alien. If it is, then many trace the source back to Roswell in 1947 and the government's supposed cover-up of the spacecraft that crashed there. In response to this, the investigative arm of Congress reopened the Roswell case in 1994 and began a search of the government records related to these events. The result was an investigation and report by the General Accounting Office.
The General Accounting Office report is brief, like most of their reports, and it simply describes what they did to try to discover what happened in Roswell, which was contact the usual suspects, the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, and so forth, and ask if they had information on Roswell, and ask to see certain records there. But essentially, they couldn't find any documents on Roswell at all, period.
In fact, the GAO revealed that all documents relating to Roswell had been illegally destroyed. If there had been government cover-ups surrounding Roswell and Area 51, we may never know what has been kept secret or if it relates to UFOs. What we do know is that now in our midst, there is a rapidly growing addition to the UFO myth. It can be summed up in just one terrifying word: abduction. Before the mid-1960s, UFO cases mostly involved sightings of unusual aircraft or lights in the night sky. In addition, there were the contact cases, where individuals reported communication with UFO occupants, often depicted as friendly and wise. But on a clear, bright night in the fall of 1961, a New England couple encountered a UFO that dramatically changed their lives and the UFO belief system. Betty and Barney Hill were an upstanding couple in their 40s. Betty was a social worker with a heavy caseload. Barney worked for the Postal Service and was an active member of the NAACP. They were driving home to New Hampshire from a vacation in Canada when their encounter began. As they motored down Route 3 in the isolated White Mountains, Betty noticed a curious star in the sky that seemed to be following their car. The Hills stopped the car as the light got closer to them, and peering through binoculars, Barney reported seeing red, amber, and green flashing lights. Panicked, Barney jumped back in the car and started speeding down the road. When the Hills arrived home to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the couple realized that the trip had taken 2 hours longer than they had planned. Within 10 days of their sighting, Betty Hill began having dreams in which she and Barney were taken aboard a flying saucer and medically examined. The Hills filed a sighting report with NICAP, a newly formed UFO research group. Then, the emotional trauma from their experience prompted Barney and Betty Hill to seek the psychiatric help of Dr. Benjamin Simon, a prominent Boston psychiatrist. Dr. Simon placed the Hills under hypnosis during a series of visits. In these sessions, the memories of the Hills' missing 2 hours were supposedly unlocked. On later listening to tape recordings of their accounts, their conscious memories were restored.
You're not going to wake up. You're in a deep sleep. You're comfortable, relaxed. This is not going to trouble you. You can remember everything now. It's right over my right. What is it? I try to maintain control so Betty cannot tell I am scared. God, I'm scared. It's all right. Go right on. Experience it. It will not hurt you now. I gotta get my gun. I gotta get my gun! All right. Just keep breathing. Calm. I put it back on. And then I get out with the binoculars. And then there. And I look. And it's just over. And I think, I'm not afraid. I'll turn it down. I'm not afraid. And I walk out. And I walk across the road. There it is, up there. Oh, God damn it!
Marty Hill would later make sketches to illustrate his story.
It's very big, and it's not that far. And I can see it tilted toward me.
Tilted? What does it look like now when you say tilted? Did you see me? It
looks like a big, big pancake with windows. And rows of windows, and I up and down the road. Can somebody come? Tell me this is not there. It can't be.
That's a man. And he captain, what is he? Look at me.
During her hypnotic regression, Betty Hill described the deeply disturbing events that she believed took place inside the landed spacecraft.
And then they rolled me over on my back, and the examiner had a long needle in his hand, and I see the needle, and it is the bigger than any needle I've ever seen. And I asked him what he's going to do with it. And he said, just a simple death, simple escape. And I asked him what. And he said he just wants to put it in my table. And just a simple death. And I told him, no, it won't hurt. Don't do it. Don't do it. And he said, no, it won't hurt. And he said to me, look at my face. And I'm crying and I tell him it's hurting and hurting and hurting. And as a leader, he goes over and he puts his hand, runs his hand in front of my eyes. And he says, I'll be alright. I won't feel it. And all the pain goes away.
5 years later, the bizarre experience of Betty and Barney Hill became legendary as a cover story in Look magazine, and later in a book called The Interrupted Journey. Both claimed to describe the first reported alien abduction in the United States. While their psychiatrist, Dr. Simon, remained skeptical of the stories the Hills related under hypnosis, the publicity opened a floodgate of reports of UFO encounters that authors like Dr. David M. Jacobs call abduction.
Well, the core abduction scenario involves basically a person who is taken out of his or her normal environment, usually against their will, and taken on board an object, a UFO, if you will, and the clothes are removed, they're placed on a table, they're given a mental, physical, and kind of reproductive series of examinations, procedures, and then they're released, brought back, and they forget about what happened to them almost immediately, although they might know that something strange has happened. They don't necessarily connect it to the abduction phenomenon.
No one has yet photographed an alien abduction, but it has become customary for victims to make drawings and sketches of their experience and the strange beings that they describe called grays.
The most predominant one are the small gray aliens and taller gray aliens as well. The taller gray aliens seem to be more in charge in the abduction scenario. The smaller gray aliens seem to be more assistants or helpers or whatever. These are beings that are thin, have no hair, large heads, very large black eyes, no pupils in them, just sort of opaque. No nose to speak of, although there might be a little bump or a ridge there.
Since the Betty and Barney Hill case of the 1960s, the use of hypnosis has figured prominently in abduction research. Its advocates claim that hypnosis can help to unlock suppressed memories, providing investigators with details of unearthly and often frightening events.
I use hypnosis to help people relax, and in a relaxed trance state, they seem to have access to these memories which have been, as it were, systematically blocked by the UFO occupants.
New York City artist and best-selling author Bud Hopkins is perhaps the leading pioneer in UFO abduction research. Since 1975, Hopkins claims to have unearthed an enormous number of similar and consistent reports. His two books, Intruders and Missing Time, have set the standards for investigating this mysterious phenomenon.
A typical hypnosis session starts in with a very sharp, clear focus on a particular event. Let's say two people in a car, and the car stopped, and they see a UFO. Everyone is paralyzed. They cannot move. Often the ship will land on the highway or hover, and little figures, small gray figures with huge black eyes, will approach the car. Usually what happens next, if the craft is on the highway, they walk up into it. But more often, if it's hovering, they go up a beam of light.
Amazingly, many of Hopkins' alien abduction reports come not from isolated backwoods locales, but from high-rise buildings and automobiles in New York City. His subjects report smooth gray beings, missing time, human experiments, and paralysis. It all sounds like science fiction gone wild. Yet, they are among hundreds of ordinary, apparently healthy people who have reported these experiences. Are they all suffering from mass delusion? Or could some parts of these experiences be true? To answer these questions, we must ask ourselves, who are the abductees?
I'm 46 years old. I have two grown kids. My daughter's 23. My son is 20. I've been married for 26 years, and I've earned a good living as a musician and a graphic artist. And for all intents and purposes, I've lived a very dull, normal, mundane kind of a life.
But John believes he has been repeatedly abducted at night from his home in New York City.
They usually start at home in the middle of the night. I'll be in a dead sleep. And I'll either jump up with a start, and they'll be in the room, and then the paralysis comes on where I just can't move.
I've been coming up the apartment stairs on my fifth floor apartment, and I saw this strange light coming through the skylight.
Rosemary believes she was lured by aliens to the roof of her apartment in Midtown Manhattan.
In the minute I got up to the roof, there was this dark circle in the sky, and I noticed it for a few seconds, and then suddenly a beam of light came and hit me. and paralyzed me and started to lift me up into the bottom of this round disc-shaped thing.
And I'll be taken out of the house and on board a craft, and the medical procedures are performed. I remember a circular, it's a round room. There's a pedestal table in the middle of this thing. There are instruments and things that come right out of the walls from the ceiling. I'll be placed on the table. I'm immobilized. I can't move.
Basically, they just put me on a table, and then some kind of a device came down and hit me in the chest because I wasn't breathing. And there were these beings around me.
This taller being will come over, and there's usually a few of them around me at that point, and one is acting kind of as an anesthetist, where he's keeping me calmed and reassured, while the other guy's performing all of these really painful, intrusive physical procedures. They will insert a probe up my nose, and I'll feel tremendous pressure, no pain, just pressure here. And you hear a crunch when the bone cracks. And then there's a penetration. These objects are being placed in my head.
Although abduction research relies heavily on stories and so-called witness accounts, the physical evidence that supports these claims is dubious.
This is a stain that came from a woman's sweater who was abducted while wearing a sweater. She came back with it. The stains were all over it. She could not imagine how she got it. And we have a whole series of these kinds of stains. Now the researchers have collected them as well. We feel that this is an artifact, that this, in fact, is something that is directly related to the abduction scenario.
Formal testing of the stained cloth has yet to reveal any substance of alien origin. Still, Hopkins recalls what he considers to be physical evidence recovered from the scene of a 1983 UFO abduction case in Indiana.
Where the UFO landed, the soil was baked directly under the craft, it would seem, into this kind of rock-like quality, down to a depth of about 7 inches. This is in the circle. But then there was a straight line coming out from it, where the soil was also cooked like this. We don't know what caused it, what kind of energy caused it, but again, here's physical evidence.
UFO researchers also point to puzzling scars, bruises, cuts, and spoop-shaped marks that abductees claim appeared as a result of their alien medical exam. Still, diagnostic images that look for an abductee's nasal implant usually reveal a normal head and sinus cavity. An implant itself has never been medically documented. Ultimately, there are only stories and stains and rocks and belief. Where, then, do these aliens come from? Science has begun to explore the brain to shed a surprising new light on the secrets of UFO abduction. To those who study UFOs in general, abduction research has all the earmarks of delusional fantasy and none of the hard, reproducible facts of scientific investigation. Even Kevin Randall, who truly believes a spacecraft crashed in Roswell, remains skeptical about reports of alien abduction.
There's been so much in the media about abductions that the people claiming to be abducted, and most of them are very sincere and sincerely believe what they're saying, and under hypnosis tell the stories, but they've all been exposed to it through the movies, through the books.
Specifically, the use of hypnosis has been criticized by those who fear the practice can lead to the formation of false memories.
Too often people say, if you're under hypnosis and you say something, it's got to be the truth. You can't lie under hypnosis. Well, that's not the truth. You can lie under hypnosis. In fact, it causes you to confabulate, to fill in the blanks, more so than just a normal discussion.
But the use of hypnosis to recover the supposed memories of UFO abduction victims continues. Despite studies like the Imaginary Abductee Survey conducted in 1977 at the California State University by Professor Alvin Lawson, Lawson asked a group of subjects with no significant UFO knowledge or experience to imagine an abduction under hypnosis. The result was a convincing abduction story where no abduction had been reported. Where then does the UFO abduction experience originate? Here at Canada's Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario, the answer may be taking shape in the laboratory of neuroscientist Dr. Michael Persinger. He believes that such experience is created in the brain.
From a neurophysiological point of view and a neuroscience point of view, the abduction phenomena or abduction experience is another variation on the sense of presence. The sense of presence is an experience that's been with the human being for thousands of years. It was the succubi and the incubi, the entities that visited nuns and priests during the 15th century. It's the fairy invasions and the angel invasions and epidemics of the 19th century and the early 20th century. This is another variation, and it's tied fundamentally to the way the human brain is organized.
But where in the brain does this imaginary sense of presence originate?
This is a human brain. It's been fixed. As you see, there are two halves, left hemisphere, the right hemisphere. And the temporal lobes are along the sides here that wrap around under. And these areas are very electrically unstable and very sensitive. And indeed, this is the area of the brain that involved, well, the gateway to memory. Dreams, intense fantasies that are so real you swear they are true, as well as the part of the brain that's involved with meaningfulness. Meaningfulness of a cosmic and sometimes even religious level.
Persinger believes these fantasies are so real, we label them alien abductions. His theory begins with a natural force that is regularly mistaken for UFO sightings. For over 40 years, geologists have demonstrated in the laboratory that when rock is broken, energy is released. A classic demonstration even produces a flash of light on film. It's the same force that sparks an electronic lighter. When this occurs in nature, as the Earth's rocky crust shifts beneath us, the energy released can cause a startling luminous display. Persinger holds that these lights, perhaps occurring over a city, might also emit electromagnetic waves that cause temporal lobe hallucinations, later recalled as an abduction.
Tingling sensations, feeling that something odd was going to happen, that they got too close, discharge, knocked unconscious, and the experiences they had were reflective of the experiences, like a dream, of what was going on. If you can't move, you can't breathe, you feel these things on your chest. If your pupils are dilated because you've been effectively knocked unconscious by the charge, your experience is intense light, pretty much like what goes into a dream.
Did Betty and Barney Hill witness a luminous phenomenon? Are modern abductees victims of the same energy? And can this force somehow trick the brain's most sensitive areas into creating an abduction experience? To answer this, we must step into the chamber of Dr. Persinger, where controlled electrical fields can be introduced to the brain, simulating an exposure to this luminous phenomenon. Undergraduate student Mike Siegel was chosen for this experiment after a screening ruled out signs of epilepsy or seizure disorder. He has reported no UFO-related experiences.
What we do is we use a motorcycle helmet, put it over the head. On both sides of the motorcycle helmet, there are solenoids embedded in it. A solenoid is a device that allows you to deliver weak magnetic fields. The magnetic fields are then pass through the brain, very weak fields, less than that, the hair blow dry. But the computers, which run the patterns, are programmed to simulate or imitate the firing pattern of the deep structures of the temporal lobe.
As a programmed sequence is initiated, waveforms from the computer are sent to the brain of the subject. These complex patterns of electromagnetic stimulation imitate the firing patterns found deep in the brain. Persinger believes that similar patterns could be generated in nature, creating startling experiences.
If we stimulate the temporal lobe towards the caudal or back part, it would be visual experiences. Towards the front, smell experiences. But the fundamental experience is that of movement, feeling out of your body, feeling displaced, feeling the sense of a presence as if someone else is in the room with you, feeling intrusive thoughts as if thoughts are coming from outside you, ego alien thoughts.
This pattern, Persinger believes, will produce an experience with many of the components of an alien abduction.
I remember feeling very light for a while, just drifting. Then I remember everything just sort of went black, and a feeling of complete weightlessness. I started seeing patterns of light, and then all of a sudden, in an instant, I feel as though there's another presence there, someone there. I can feel it. I'm almost sure that if I turn my head, I know I'm going to see something there. And the hairs on the back of your neck seem to stand. It's as if someone's breathing in your ear. I saw sort of distorted images of people that I knew, or at least I thought I knew. And then I felt this tremendous sort of rush of fear, tremendous anxiety. I wanted to get out. If I could have ripped off the electrodes and gotten out of the room, I would have. My legs felt like they weighed 2 tons. I couldn't move them if I wanted to. And I just felt cold. I started to shiver.
It was here that the experience took on the startling characteristics of an encounter with the aliens known as the Greys.
The lights were most definitely white. Pure white. And then I saw the people. And then I felt this rush of fear. And as far as the people, they were grayish. It was a grayish color. They seemed to not really shine, just like wax. That's pretty much the only way I could describe it, like wax. Grayish, elongated, wax people.
Abduction researchers would point out that although Mike saw gray beings, he did not recall a complete abduction experience in the laboratory.
There's a big difference between having these experiences in the laboratory where you know you're safe as opposed to in your bedroom late at night in an ambiguous and scary setting or out in the middle of the forest somewhere. If they see a ball of light or an unusual presentation of a stimulus, the label they put on it will determine their experience.
A poll conducted in 1992 by the Roper Organization revealed that at least 2% of the American population believe they have had some form of UFO abduction or missing time experience.
If you put a label that's a UFO, the experience will be determined by everything they know about UFOs. If they say it's a religious experience or an angel, the experience will be in context of a religious explanation. So in many respects, the label a person places upon an unusual phenomenon determines how you recall it.
This may explain the celebrated visions seen by thousands in Fatima, Portugal in 1917. Religious people saw the Virgin Mary. Others reported disc-shaped objects in the heavens. The camera captured only a luminous cloud. In an adjacent laboratory, Dr. Persinger is creating a computer model that correlates earthquakes to reports of strange lights in the sky and UFOs. If he is correct, then the Earth itself may be the cause of UFO sightings and abduction reports. But the Earth offers still other puzzles that may be connected to UFO activity far from Persinger's lab in Canada. In England, researchers persistently look for meaning in the strange patterns that appear there in fields of wheat. They have been called a riddle, wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma. They are perfectly formed and appear without warning. They stand silently as mysterious symbols of unknown meaning and intent. These are the circles and lines that appear in fields each summer across England. Some say they are messages from alien beings. To researchers, they represent a mystery that may be tied to UFOs.
Crop circles were connected to UFO phenomena beginning in the early 80s, soon after they appeared in England, because people figured round marks on the ground, gee, they're like UFO traces that UFOs have left before, so why not UFOs causing these things? Because they are mysterious, they can't seem to find the source of them.
When UFOs purportedly land, the traces they leave are rough and any plants involved burned or crushed, a component not associated with crop circles. This unevenly flattened ring in the grass was discovered in Saskatchewan, Canada in 1979, after a white light had been seen above it the night before. Its cause has never been explained. Then, a year later in 1980, perfect forms and symbols began to appear in Bratton, Wiltshire, England. Farmers here called the simple shapes corn circles and wrote them off as a quirk of nature. But the months and years that followed brought an explosion of new sightings. Crop circle magazines quickly emerged to publicize the elaborate and beautiful patterns that were now visiting other crops. Researchers who called themselves seriologists stepped in to quantify these strange patterns and discover common traits or fingerprints.
I think the fingerprint, which is consistently present in the genuine crop circle, is the spiraling symmetry, that preciseness, that well-defined spiral that terminates its job from the center of the circle to the circumference of that simple circle in less than one revolution.
Colin Andrews is by far the best known of the seriologists. An engineer by training, he has devoted his time to the study of this modern enigma. Andrews is convinced that true crop circles are not the work of human beings.
What makes the crop circle phenomenon inexplicable is the fact that, first of all, we have within those geometric forms a total lack of damage. No footmarks, no compression of the soil. And the geometry is extremely precise. These patterns, one has to say, smacks of communication. These are complex arrays. They must mean something.
In 1993 alone, Andrews recorded over 300 of the patterns in the English countryside. Witnesses have tied some to reports of UFO sightings. In 1986, while driving through Stockbridge Down at night, Pat and Jack Collins stopped their car in an area where a crop circle was later to be found.
As we came over the brow of the hill behind you, then...
You said to me, didn't you? Cool, look quick at that.
Yeah. There was this circle with lights all around the edge, and would appear to have been spokes, which were also lit.
I saw this enormous big thing. It was like sort of looking at a great wheel at a fairground. It looked that size.
Although no one has yet seen a UFO making a crop circle, Andrews believes they are behind the mystery.
That that comes through very, very regularly is a small disc-shaped object, approximately 12 to 14 inches in diameter, seen by day as being highly reflective, pulsing, and moving through the heads of the planets and moving away into the sky at a very high rate of speed.
In July of 1990, observers in the area of England called Milk Hill took this home video of such a UFO. The picture shows a reflective white object hovering over the field and moving through the plants. Adjacent to this spot was a newly formed crop circle. Are crop circles evidence of alien visitors? To solve the mystery, a commercial film company in England undertook a nighttime stakeout in 1991 of a cornfield in Wiltshire. It was here the filmmakers made a startling discovery. Thermal imaging equipment revealed the faint outline of humanoid shapes moving in a circle. The shapes were in fact quite human and belonged to a pair of Englishmen named Doug Bauer and Dave Chorley. Doug and Dave claimed responsibility for dozens of the complex patterns that had caused so much mystery. Many circles, the twosome pointed out, were even signed with their initials, D and D.
The circles that we created in 1978 with the standing walls of corn as if they'd been cut out of pastry with a knife, they were our doing, and we started it way back in that time.
Ultimately, crop circles offered nothing to the search for interplanetary communication. And while seriologists continue to search for true meaning in the designs, science looks to fields like this to get a message from another race of intelligent beings. These are radio telescopes pointed toward the heavens in a search for faint signals from outer space. Physicists believe they may well hold our best chance of contact with intelligent beings from other planets. And at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Earth's most sophisticated detector in the search for life in outer space is being updated in a laboratory. It will scan the skies looking for answers to one of humanity's oldest questions. Is anybody out there? The project is headed by Dr. Paul Horowitz.
We're looking, first and foremost, for a signal generated by an intelligent species somewhere else. We have to guess what kind of signal that might be. First of all, is it light? Is it radio waves? Is it particles? Best guess is it's radio waves. Best guess amongst the radio wave possibilities are microwaves. What kind of signal there? It's anyone's guess. Some people believe a carrier, a single long transmission, transmitter left on, probably saying nothing, just saying I'm here.
Scientists have known about radio since the start of the 20th century, but only in this decade have advances in computers provided tools powerful enough for SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Our current search has 250 million channels of radio receiver. And when I say 250 million, I don't mean like a scanner one after the other. I mean like having 250 million radios on your desk all tuned to adjacent channels. That is, I believe, the largest radio spectrometer on Earth.
Previous efforts have been less specialized using receivers not custom made for the search. What sits here in the lab, stripped to its silicon guts, is only half the system. Soon, it will be linked to a large radio antenna, and the search to detect a signal from an alien civilization will begin.
Our search uses an 84-foot steerable radio telescope. Looks like a backyard satellite dish, but much bigger. It can collect rather weak signals and concentrate them at the focus. There we have some very sensitive amplifiers, the best that can be made these days, to strengthen that very weak signal.
The tiny signals will be transmitted through cables into the control room, where an array of computers will sort through the cosmic noise looking for signs of intelligence. But what are the odds that we will get a signal from some exotic civilization?
That there's other life in the universe, guaranteed. That there's other life in the galaxy, guaranteed. Any odds you like, absolutely cannot be any other way. That there's advanced life somewhere in the universe, guaranteed. Somewhere else in the galaxy, so extremely probable that I would give you at least 100 to 1 odds that interstellar communication could well be taking place.
But if other civilizations are out there, where are they, and why aren't they here? Even we humans are space travelers. Wouldn't any civilization advanced enough to send a message come to Earth in person? In reality, space visitors would have to travel a long way, for we on Earth seem to have no close neighbors. The Voyager 2 spacecraft was the fastest vehicle ever built by humans, but it still took 9 years to reach the planet Uranus, just over halfway to the edge of the solar system. To find another advanced civilization, we must turn our attention to the stars and any life-bearing planets that surround them. But Voyager would take 100,000 years to reach even the closest stars. Aliens would face the same daunting reality to travel here. For this reason, science tells us to expect distant, not close encounters with extraterrestrial beings. Dr. Horowitz believes that his search holds the promise of one day receiving a distant message from other intelligent life in the universe.
And this will be quite an event. This will be the first bridge across 4 billion years of independent life starting evolution. It will be the end of Earth's cultural isolation in a galaxy and a universe containing surely millions of other civilizations. It will be, without doubt, the greatest discovery in the history of humankind.
For now, we are the eyes and ears of the universe, but the future may hold a wondrous discovery, a tiny signal that someday tells us we are not alone. Coming up, UFOs have been with us longer than we may think. We have watched in fascination as a persistent body of remarkable stories and sighting reports gave rise to a provocative UFO myth. But still, we must ask, where are all the UFOs? Those who chronicle folklore and human traditions would say UFOs have always been with us in some mysterious form. Dr. Thomas E. Bullard has made the study of such folklore his life's work.
We can't believe in ghosts or witches or demons anymore, or at least most people don't anymore. That's against our worldview. But aliens fit in perfectly with it. They are technologically advanced, and their technology is equivalent to a form of magic. They do the very sorts of things that the supernatural beings of the past did, but they do them for their alien scientific purposes, all of which fits in perfectly well with our current worldview. So the function of these aliens is the same as the supernatural beings of the past.
As these images from the 15th century demonstrate, mankind has always described strange objects seen in the sky and tried to explain them in ways that were appropriate to their culture and place and time. This Italian Renaissance painting depicts a typical Madonna and child and a structured object in the sky, a UFO that has light rays emanating from it. How far back, we must wonder, does this mythology go?
Mythology is eternal. It's always been there and it always will be. But the mythology itself will change to fit the society it reflects. In ancient times, people saw signs in the sky. People saw mythological beings. Then came World War II, the V-2 rocket, the atom bomb. And so when we saw things in the sky, we didn't see angels. We saw machines. We saw technological devices with performance greater than anything humans could accomplish. But ultimately, it is still mythology. It still fills the same role that mythology has always filled for humans.
And so it is with the flying saucer myth, whose prologue goes back 100 years to November of 1896, when, just before air travel became a reality, people from California to the Midwest began to see their own brand of UFOs.
In the 1890s, people began seeing what they called phantom airships. They were expecting that the crowning achievement of the 19th century would be successful aerial navigation. They saw a big light in the sky, and some people said that they could see the shadowy form of an aircraft behind this bright light. They said it looked like a big gas bag, an oval-shaped object, that it had propellers, and oftentimes they said they could see wings. They could even hear the voices of the pilot on board or the passengers.
What witnesses were reporting could not have existed in 1890. There are no records of such fantastic aircraft in aviation history.
People saw what they called airships flying about, sometimes at tremendous speed, sometimes hovering, sometimes stopping on a dime, sometimes with very strong lights pointed downward coming out of them. And they saw airships. This is sort of their cultural expectation, was to see a blimp-like object.
Cartoons of the era even tried to pass off the sightings as a product of the 19th century pastime of smoking opium. During this first great UFO wave, as in modern times, people saw something unusual overhead, then reported objects that they could explain. There was even speculation that these rustic craft were invented by men from the moon.
1947, Kenneth Arnold said he thought he was seeing some experimental jets. Well, that's what people expected to see in 1947, and that's exactly what most of the reports describe. And since then, there has been a sort of elaboration that does come more and more to reflect some of the anticipations that we have. It doesn't mean there's nothing there. There usually is a stimulus, and it may be a very unusual stimulus. But to come to grips with it, they're always putting it in terms of their own culture, their own expectations.
So, where are all the UFOs?
When you get down to it, what we have always is a story. I saw something. I saw a light in the sky. I saw a crashed flying saucer. And a story is mythology. It is not in and of itself proof. Where are the pieces of debris? Where are the really good photos? Something more than a light in the sky. Where is that photo evidence that would for all time end the question, are we being visited by alien beings? And it's never there.
Humanity has always watched the skies in wonder. We gaze at the heavens and search the stars, hoping to find order and meaning to our lives. In the end, perhaps what we are seeing is a reflection of ourselves.